My guest, Albert Mobilio, is a writer, critic, editor, and teacher. Mobilio was raised in Pennsylvania and studied at Penn State University before moving to New York City to work towards a master's degree at Columbia. He left the program early, however, and went on to work as an editor at the Modern Language Association and a contributing editor at the Village Voice. He's also served as an editor at Book Forum and Hyperallergic, in addition to publishing, by my count, 7 books of poetry, 1 book of short fiction, numerous short stories, and countless reviews and critical essays. Mobilio's criticism is marked by its clear, precise prose and his deep insights into the work he's considering and its place in the world. His poetry and short fiction invoke both inner and outer spheres and are imbued with a wry, often dark sense of humor. Speaking of this, Mobilio has said, "I tend to find writing that takes itself too seriously or speaks earnestly about important things less compelling as an influence than writing that approaches significance with stealth, humor, and a wink. At some level, I believe all art must amuse. I know that sounds trivial, privileged to be sure, but I value self-consciousness shot through with irony, wit, and play because, well, it's the voice I have." Albert, what do you mean when you say that all art should amuse?
Well, it's good to be amused. I think that art is, we often think of it as this rather freighted sense of human expression. But I think we express ourselves always, I think, in a performative way, even in our most dire moments. I suppose if you are drowning, you're thinking, I should be screaming as loud as I can. So there's an element of craft, even perhaps at that moment. But I use amuse in the broadest sense. That doesn't necessarily mean you should be chuckling, but that you should be made to be perhaps more curious. You should be perplexed. I think being offended, in a sense, can constitute a kind of amusement. Perhaps distracting or distracted would be a better word there. Art that shifts our focus from ourselves to something else and then back to ourselves. That's what I mean by being amused.
I'm interested in the qualifier that you use with that statement. You said, "I know that sounds trivial," which suggests that you believe otherwise, that you think that things that might on the surface appear trivial can actually open the doors to much deeper concerns.
I think so. Trivial art or literature that calls out to big themes, that seeks to speak largely about things. I think when we receive this, when we read these kinds of books or poems, we're very aware that we are being, if not preached to, that the experience is meant to be meaningful. And I think all kinds of guards can then go up against that, resisting being told what to think or resisting the importance of that communication. Whereas art that, as I said, kind of creeps up on an issue or a mode of thinking, creeps up on some kind of metaphor more stealthily, has much more of a chance of creeping inside of you, of making some kind of mark that's memorable.
You've also said literature might be best approached as play. And speaking about the writing of your book of short fictions, Games and Stunts, you said, "I had the thought that games are the dark cousins of play. Play is about the pleasure of doing, games more about the pleasure of having done, of completion, of victory." And you've also said that you don't enjoy games very much, but you clearly love to play. So in what ways do you play?
Oh, well, in what ways do I play? I think that the process is often one of being open to, attuned to sounds, to the look of things on the page, to the sound of words, to their musicality, and then beginning to think about orchestrating those elements more as elements than as any potential fealty to an emotion or to a narrative. That's something that gradually reveals itself to me and then maybe becomes part of an effort at shaping. But I think initially I'm attracted to the sound of words, to the enjambment of images. Many of these things, some of the books on my list, some of these writers, and the first one that we'll talk about is Gertrude Stein.
Well, I was just about to say, this is the perfect time to talk about the first book on your list.
Yeah, and let me just say, almost all of these books I encountered and read probably before the age of 20. Certainly the World Book Encyclopedia. I was very, very young. And almost all of them come out of my experience as a reader in high school and probably the first 2 years of college. The Yale Gertrude Stein, which was edited by Richard Castellanets, is a book that, again, sometimes the attraction to books has to do with rather superficial things, like a book's cover. The idea that it was the Yale Gertrude Stein, I really didn't know who Gertrude Stein was other than some awareness of her role in Paris in the 1920s, her relationship with Hemingway. And so I remember pulling this book off the shelf and beginning to read at random. And I remember hitting upon stanzas in meditation and the very first line, "I caught a bird which had made a ball and they thought better of it." I remember liking the sound of that. And throughout the poem, that plural pronoun is used, or at least that stanza one, the they, they're never described. That puzzled me and also intrigued me. So Stein, I think, is someone who played a very different game than a lot of the other modernists. If we think about people like Pound and Joyce, they developed these elaborate works that really reward you if you have the keys, right? If you understand the illusions, if you have the right education, you can unlock a certain level of meaning from the cantos or from Ulysses, say. Whereas there's an element, a very strong element in Stein that can appeal to children who do not necessarily know much about economics or the Odyssey. But on the level of sound and on the level of imagery, that doesn't have to make sense. "I caught a bird which made a ball." That's just absolutely lovely. It works on the level of alliteration. It describes something that seems like it could have happened, but we just don't know enough. A literate adult would be more likely to question that than a six-year-old.
You wrote a beautiful essay on Stein, Albert, called "The Lost Generator, Gertrude Stein Builds a Better Reader." And in that, you say, in Stein, we're sent back to our earliest experiences with written words, when their size, shape, and sound were as consequential as the information they conveyed. I think that's a really lovely invocation of the experience of wonder and the power of language. It sounds as if that's what you felt on picking up that book. So I'm curious whether you could talk more about that as it relates to Stein, but also whether and what perhaps that's inspired in your own work.
In terms of Stein, I think in that essay I probably quote, and it's one of my favorite quotes of hers, I think I point out in that essay that she admonished Hemingway with the quote, "Hemingway, remarks are not literature," which is one of her quotable quotes. When she visited the U.S. in, I think, 1934, she was rather eloquently answering reporters' questions because she was a rather famous yet unread writer. And one of the reporters asked her something like, "Well, why don't you write the way you speak?" And she responded by saying, "Why don't you read the way I write?" I think there's a way in which that kind of focus on the materiality of language, on sound, on the shape of words, is a way of redirecting readerly attention in much the same way as Abex painters or any number of artists in the 20th century focused on the materiality of painting. Ad Reinhardt forces us to really look at black, for instance. Rothko insists that we look at color. Frankenthaler insists that we look at the shape of color. So I think that Stein is one of the earliest writers to really attend to that.
It's interesting that as a society, I suppose, we've come to terms with abstract painting more than we have with the writing of someone like Gertrude Stein. I wonder if you're hopeful that our conditioning to read in a linear fashion, to expect rational sense, will ever be broken down in the same way that we've now come to accept abstract painting, for example.
You raise an issue that I've thought about a number of times. Yes, there's a way in which certain visual vocabulary is now, I think, routinely understood. We're a few generations past the point where an educated person would look at an abstract painting and say the old line, "My child could do that." I think that people do understand what non-representational visual imagery is doing. But I think that the expectation about sentences and paragraphs and about language is much stronger, that it should provide some kind of meaning. I think there are those that can mitigate that expectation. There is an audience for non-narrative or disjunctive writing, but it's certainly never going to be a large one.
Yes, and you're one of those people. You've said, that's my sweet spot between what's said and what's heard, the uncertain space where mistakes arise and dislocations appear, the zone of perplexity. What is it about the zone of perplexity that draws you in?
I think the experience of not quite knowing what is happening, of not quite understanding what you are reading or the experience that you're having. It's a moment that's tinged with some anxiety. It's a moment that's tinged with some apprehension. I feel like it's an exciting or even amusing place to be. I'm not saying that every time one reads a disjunctive line of poetry or narrative that one goes into this vertiginous state, but it can be a low-key percolating effect throughout a text where you are a bit unsteady. I don't know if that's my steady diet of literary intake, but I do find it a very interesting one. It's certainly much more compelling, for instance, in poetry than the poetry of anecdote. Years ago, when I was writing for The Voice, I would talk about coffee cup epiphanies that occur in poems, where at the end of the poem, someone realizes something about themselves or about someone else. I always had a so what attitude about that. The realization is never particularly dynamic or compelling. And I've been taken through this scene where someone meets someone or someone looks at clothes flapping on a clothesline, and then they reflect upon that. And again, there's a so what effect to that.
Albert, I'm curious about perplexity in relation to your own poems or stories and what that feels like to write a piece that you don't understand.
I enjoy it to the extent that I have often gone back to pieces that I've written after a number of years and been surprised by something that I find in them. I'm not so sure that that avenue of approach is open to everyone. I don't know how many people are going back and rereading Mobilio after years, but for me, it offers a particular pleasure. If the work is unsteady in the world, then it can be approached anew.
Well, that's a lovely segue, I think, to the second book on your list.
Well, there's actually a rather apt segue, Labyrinth, a selection of stories of Jorge Luis Borges. I think my first semester in college, I was reading that book. I left it in the house while I was home for a weekend. My father had not finished high school. He was an intelligent and in some ways illiterate individual, although he didn't really read much at all, but was capable of writing rather voluble letters. He was a union activist. So he would write lots of letters to the National Labor Relations Board that were really quite articulate. But he was suspicious of the whole college issue, the whole studying literature proposition. And I came home one afternoon and he asked me what this book was. He had picked the book up and he had started reading The Library of Babel, a very famous story. And his perplexity expressed itself as, "What is this shit?" He said, I couldn't make heads or tails of this. My father didn't understand what that was about. He didn't understand why someone would do that. And it wasn't telling a story. And I think that for him raised this question. If someone isn't telling him a story or informing him about something that's real, why would they bother to put it in a book? And I was reading Borges because I was very attracted to what I felt in his work, a kind of a willfulness of the imagination. There's very little reality in Borges. There's a wonderful poem of his, I can't remember the title, that is set at a moment of uncertainty at dawn in Buenos Aires. And the poem is about the fact that the people who have been up all night, they have willed Buenos Aires into being. And it's a tenuous moment because they're going to bed and people are just waking up, the people that will take on the day shift of willing Buenos Aires into being. So it's kind of like a shift change of willing Buenos Aires into being. And I was very attracted to that element that I would couple to the famous quote of Mallarmé's, everything in the world exists to end up in a book. That there really wasn't this substantial reality of fathers and sons and families and conflicts that one was supposed to write about, but it was really more about what one might invent.
How did you answer your dad's question?
I can't say that I recall. I do remember that it was one of those moments where I understood what he meant. I understood his being perplexed. I understood his dismay that this was what his son seemed to be heading toward in the world. I don't recall that I had a particularly good response.
Albert, an early story in your book, Games and Stunts, is titled Grab a Pin. It describes a game in which one player, whose name is Jess, tries to grab a pin that's being protected by another player, whose name is Bean. And the story ends with the climactic moment in which Jess tries to get the pin only to find Bean blocking her way. And if I may, I'd just like to read the last few sentences. You wrote that Bean's teeth were bared like headlights. He shifts into her path, his panting displaying more effort than he would like to show. As they close in on one another, he reaches out, the anticipated tag already palpable. Jess shrinks back, her torso twisting away from him. Down to her molecules, she wills herself smaller. The two of them could be dancing or falling, or they could be about to get as near to something as you can without quite touching. This is so interesting, Albert, because you've described your work, and I quote here, as rather small picture, but it seems to me that that last sentence might be a metaphor for your endeavor, that you're seeking in your work to invoke the ineffable, that which we can sense, but which we can never quite articulate or touch.
I think that you're likely right about that. I certainly am dispositionally, emotionally, I'm a glass half empty person rather than a glass half full. And I think that that emotional disposition has an aesthetic implication. I don't necessarily believe in the communicability of thought or of emotions. I mean, I think that we are always not quite touching. We talk about touching, and we have a world of culture built around that idea, whether it's in theater or painting. We use that expression, I was touched by this. I just have doubts about that. I think certainly the passage that you read seems to express that.
I think it also goes back to what you were saying earlier about coming up from around the side, perhaps, to express something through a more roundabout route. And I think you might say a quieter route. That's how I take your description of your work when you say it's rather small picture.
Well, I think that I would place that idea, which I think you're dead on about, that I would place that in an imagined and rather unlikely scenario in which adults are playing some kind of game in a field. That's what I would mean by small picture.
I did want to ask why you decided in Games and Stunts to make the characters adults. I'm struck by the seriousness that they bring to their tasks. They're engaged in the game with the same fervor and passion that one brings to life, which is, of course, the way that children are. So your choice to make the characters adults is an interesting one.
I agree, and I made them adults, certainly so that I could equip them with a kind of an awareness and adult consciousness. It's a cliche to say that life is a game, or that relationships or family life, any number of things, have a game-like aspect. I suppose more realistic fiction would attempt to portray family interactions, friends interactions, romantic interactions, and that a reader or a critic might say, this writer portrays these human relationships and reveals their underlying motives that are not dissimilar to games. And I thought that this was a way of sort of stripping away the realistic depiction and presenting people doing something rather unlikely and still imbued with the emotions evoked by a literal game that they're playing, which of course these adults would not necessarily be doing.
It's also striking that there are really no winners to most of these games, or losers.
But if I think that, if that would be a theme that I would be attempting to air out, I suppose I would be wary of presenting that again in some kind of realistic scenario, but rather to present it in a slightly comical and unrealistic, if not outright bizarre scenario. Therein lies the stealth.
Albert, you also, and I read your quote at the beginning of our conversation, your differentiation between games and play. You said that games are more about the pleasure of having done, of completion, whereas play is about the pleasure of doing. What do you mean when you say that games are more about the pleasure of having done?
Well, I think games are about goals. There are, as you say, there are generally winners and losers in a game. Games, they are the ultimate mechanism of establishing hierarchies. People talk about educational institutions as having a game-like aspect. Some people graduate at the top of their class and some people at the bottom. The expression, you have to learn how to play the game, is applicable to almost any human endeavor, except perhaps play, except perhaps rolling a red ball on the floor or enjoying its roundness or its redness, which seems more in line to me with what play might be, or simply experiencing pleasure. When someone says, you have to learn to play the game in the literary world, they're not saying, this is going to be a lot of fun. This is going to bring you pleasure. They're saying that you need a strategy. You need to make certain self-aggrandizing moves. You need to win a series of small battles on your way to winning whatever war you think you're engaged in. I do think that games are, or the idea of games, much more insidious.
Let's hear about another book, Albert, the third on your list.
I think I suggested neither of my parents were particularly literary people or educated. Neither of them even got halfway through high school. But they were really good people and aware people. And they probably, when I was about 5 or 6, they purchased a World Book Encyclopedia. And my father actually built this bookcase. And when he passed away, the bookcase was in the Philadelphia area. And I would have loved to have brought it to New York, but it was huge and I couldn't have done it. But it's probably one of the more meaningful objects in my life. But I did bring a bunch of the volumes. I brought the entire encyclopedia, all 19 volumes, some of them combined 2 letters. And that's the origin point for me as a reader and my interest in the world. There were no novels in my house necessarily, or I don't even know, aside from Life magazine, if we had magazine subscriptions. But we had the World Book Encyclopedia, as opposed to the Britannica, which is a much more erudite and elite encyclopedia. The World Book And this had been published in 1960, so it reflected the world as of probably 1958, 1957. It was illustrated. It had a lot of pictures and drawings. So for instance, looking recently at the volume L, remembering looking up literature, and of course, there was an illustration of a monk laboring over a manuscript, or a bearded man wearing a toga strumming a lyre. So for a very young person, it was not the sort of chock-a-block all text with the tiniest possible illustration that you would get in the Britannica, but it was visually various and inviting. I read from one thing to another. I was just looking at this volume today, and on a single page, you have Leviathan, the concept, and a ship named Leviathan, Leviticus, and a whole page on levers and the law of equilibrium. I would just plow through one after another, looking in this volume and remembering looking at the several pages devoted to London with its maps and the pictures of the beefeater guards at the Tower of London. I remember reading the word tortillas in the pages devoted to Los Angeles and not knowing what a tortilla was. There's a quote of Samuel Johnson's where he says, "Everything I know, I learned by the age of 17. I would say that that's perhaps true. I think I'm still living off the fumes of things that I read in an encyclopedia that at this point is about 75 years old. It was absolutely foundational. If you think of a consensus consciousness, there's a way in which an encyclopedia represents that. From this particular juncture, we would look at a world book and a Britannica encyclopedia and say, well, that represents a consensus consciousness, one that's very, very particular, and we would critique it as such. But at the time, well, it was called the world book. And I felt like I was journeying in some way through, I would have never described it as such, but journeying through a global consciousness. And that there wasn't a particular narrative. I was moving from point to point. I was moving from Leviticus to the law of equilibrium. The same page that has Ring Lardner has Joseph Lister. There wasn't a kind of tale of Western civilization or here's the story of the world. It was a lot of data points that were not necessarily contiguous and that were often juxtaposed in ways that you could probably write a very nice surrealist poem.
I was going to say that those unlikely collisions would have been formative.
I think they absolutely were.
You were told, Albert, by your parents at a very young age that you had been adopted and that your birth mother had been killed in a car accident, but you later found out that they hadn't told you the full story. I imagine that could have been really confusing for a young boy. Why do you think your parents told you that you were adopted when they did? And how did it affect you?
We're talking about the same time as getting the World Book Encyclopedia, about 1960 or so. And my parents were Catholic. But I think also in 1960, the reality of the situation, which was I was an illegitimate child, that my mother had given me up for adoption because she was very young. And one thing I know, and I'm not sure how, but she was in college. And that would have been, I think, hard to explain to a 5 or 6 year old what illegitimacy was, since that would have meant explaining what sex was in and outside of marriage. I think it was a very strange and perhaps somewhat self-serving narrative. I did have this image in my head for a number of years of my parents having this car accident and flying through a windshield. I don't know why that was the image I had. And self-serving in the sense that it kind of cut off any questions. Had they told me that your parents are both alive, I might ask questions about them. We live in a different time now about adoptions in general. Most adoptions now, if not all of them, I believe, are what are called open adoptions, where everyone's aware of everything, et cetera. But I think at that time, adoptions were shrouded in a good deal more secrecy and maintaining the illusion of of a sort of genetically related family was more important in some ways.
Do you think they thought that you somehow might find out? I mean, I guess I'm wondering about the timing, that you were so young. Perhaps there's never an easy time to tell a child that they're adopted.
It was a smart move on their part because it just became a part of the narrative we all develop about ourselves. I think my mother presented it as most children just appear in their families, but we chose you. So there was something presumably special about that. And the fact that my birthday is December 24th and that my mother's name was Mary led to certain delusions, I suppose, of being chosen. But they did the best that they might have done at that particular time around those issues, those very charged issues of family relations, sexuality, illegitimacy.
You just mentioned being chosen, and of your childhood, you've said the condition of being an only child is to be special. You've touched a little bit on ways that you felt special, but I wonder if there are other ways. And also, conversely, were there ways that you felt burdened by your parents' attention?
I've had an opportunity to recapitulate this issue because I'm a father of an only child, a son. And I've had the opportunity to witness from the parental point of view that particular, and it is a kind of a burden. You are at the vortex of a triangle, two people's attention focused on you and you alone. Your sense of family is not, I think, a social sense of family. Even a single sibling means you are part of a social group, but an only child is in this triangular attention. They are the focal point. And I think that it can lead you to think that you are special. I was always very aware of the cliches surrounding only children, that they are somehow spoiled, or that's the old-fashioned word. The current word, I guess, would be entitled. And I was always aware of that. I grew up in a very working-class milieu, working-class Catholic milieu. Around me were any number of large families. They were not untypical for families to have four and five, sometimes more, kids. Because it was a working class community, kids wore hand-me-downs. I thought I was privileged because I had a new football or something like that. So I had a rather keen sense of being different in that regard.
You pressed your parents, who you've said were not big fans of Robert Kennedy, to take you to see the train.
Oh, yeah.
Which carried his body as it passed through your town on the way to Washington, D.C. What made you want to see the train? And what was your experience of that day?
This was 1968. Martin Luther King had been assassinated just weeks before. That summer, the whole world would erupt. Chicago, the Democratic Convention, the police riot there. I think I was very attuned to events. The Kennedys were magic in those years. And again, I was in this community that was very Catholic. Even the nuns were gaga for Bobby. It was a very particularly Irish Catholic milieu. So the girls that I had crushes on loved Bobby. You know, I wanted to be a part of this experience. We were all watching it on TV. I'm old enough to have recalled spending the 3 days in front of our tiny black and white TV watching the aftermath of JFK's assassination. I was watching live that Sunday morning when Oswald was shot. So I think that those things were all very present and felt crucial at the moment. Because my father was a Teamster and Bobby Kennedy had been part of the, as the Teamsters would have put it, or my father would have put it, the persecution of Jimmy Hoffa for his blatant corruption as union leader. My father had this strong fealty to Jimmy Hoffa. They were probably what they called the Reagan Democrats, avant la lettre, you know, in 1960. I think they probably voted for Nixon because they perceived the Kennedys to be rich boys who were pursuing the working man's knight in shining armor.
Let's talk about another book, Albert, number four.
A Controversy of Poets, which was a volume, an anthology of contemporary poetry that was edited by Paris Leary and Robert Kelly, and I believe was published in the mid-60s. I came across this book again in high school. A Controversy of Poets was my introduction to the Beats, to John Ashbery, Leroy Jones, later Amiri Baraka, also people like Adrian Rich, Anne Sexton, more established figures like Frederick Seidel, who I did not know when I was reading him then that I would savage him in a review in the New York Times a half century later. But people like James Dickey, Robert Creeley, all these people that would become important to me. And the book, it just had a particular size. I still have the copy. The spine is split, so it's cleaved in two. It was almost 600 pages. It's about the size of a pocket paperback. So it's very dense. It's a book like a brick. And I must say, I just loved carrying it around. I loved owning it. I loved the feel of it. It was like, I don't know, it was like a brick. And I must say, the poetry was just beyond me. And I was probably 16 or 17, and reading some of it, I couldn't quite get what these people were trying to do. But to return to this theme, I was puzzled by it and intrigued and was enjoying it. I was amused by it, but I couldn't do what I was doing in my English class, which was writing a paper on what the Scarlet Letter meant in Hawthorne's novel. There seemed to be no themes that I could divine from many of these poems.
Did you have friends that you shared your brick with?
My brick.
Or at least your perplexity about what you were reading?
I didn't. I don't really think that I did, no.
Your parents were both practicing Catholics, as you've said, and you were an altar boy who attended a parochial school. You've spoken of having a reverence as a child that you no longer have, and also an ongoing engagement with religious music and art, which you've described as vibrant beyond my ability to comprehend it. What caused you to lose your sense of faith? And what is it that keeps you enthralled and moved by religious art and music, even as you know you're not engaging with it as a believer?
I've probably said elsewhere, and I think it's pretty standard, if not cliche, that the moment for many people that tests their religious faith is somewhat similar, and it has to do with discovering masturbation. I was in a Catholic high school. I had Jesuit teachers. We're talking about 1969, 1970, 71. The cultural and sexual changes and sexual revolution was in full swing at that time. And there was a good deal of pushback. And while simultaneously, there was a need to sort of engage with these issues. The Catholic Church is extremely repressive when it comes to sexuality, as is, well, a good deal of religion. And at a certain point, one realizes, and I'm certainly not alone in this, that this simple bodily pleasure is the subject of so much condemnation. It raises the question, how could this omnipotent being, the entity that sent galaxies spinning through the universe, be concerned with my small doings in my bedroom? It seemed anomalous beyond reconciliation. And particularly the Catholic Church, again, I think almost all religions are so earnest and so vigorous in this condemnation. Perhaps if it were just a small thing that, oh, by the way, you should really watch out for your sexual behavior. You should try to be a bit more conscious and aware of not hurting people. But no, it was this war on pleasure. And that pretty much is the end of believing in the remonstrating bearded fellow in the sky, right?
But the Catholic Church has produced art and music that is still really meaningful for you. If you're not approaching it from the perspective of a devotee, how are you experiencing it?
Aesthetically, if I were to think, let's say, of the art history devoted to Renaissance art, most of those art critics are Jewish. So I don't know if they're approaching, you know, a depiction of the dead Christ. They're thinking about the role of foreshortening as an aesthetic component, not, oh, well, that's Jesus who died for my sins. So I think that I don't see that much of a problem in approaching religious art in the same way that I can enjoy reading about Kabbalah or reading about Maori myths or entering into these universes that are essentially theological. They are aesthetic objects. Any religion is a text, a compilation of ideas and a system. And in a way, to return to this idea, a game, particularly Christianity, is a game. Winners end up achieving salvation and losers condemned to hell. The big differences in various strains of Christianity have to do with the rules for playing that game, whether it's faith alone will save you or acts, right? This is the great division behind the Reformation. But it seems to me that religions have that component.
I wonder if in your comment that religious art and music is vibrant beyond my ability to comprehend it, there's a sense of what we spoke about a little bit earlier, the things that we feel but can't quite articulate or touch, which the formal might take us to, but it seems to me that the formal is not the, it's not the end.
It's not the end. There seems to be something, and I've wondered about this, is it synaptic? Does it exist on the level of brain chemistry? That quote, beyond my comprehension, I'm not sure what I was writing about or thinking about at that time, but it may likely have been some experiences that I had as a child, particularly the Stations of the Cross, which is this ritual in which one moves through what's called the Passion of Christ through a set of incidents. And I certainly remember one, probably when I was in the third grade, one does this on Good Friday between the hours of 12 and 3, which, contrary to any sense of actual history, one is told that these are the hours that Christ hangs on the cross. And I just remember having, I mean, it's a word, we use this word, transcendent, but I just remember just feeling kind of lifted out of myself in this profound sense of being in communion with the past, in communion with not just the people in the church at the moment, but in my third grade, however old I was, 7 or 8, my sense of being in communion with people around the world who were all focused at that moment on the torture and crucifixion of Jesus. And that's the kind of thing that I certainly remember the hair standing up on the back of my neck. Now, in later life, I would feel that same feeling standing on top of Half Dome, for instance, and looking out over the Sierras. But I don't know what's behind that. It's clearly, at some level, biochemistry. But what causes that? And that is a bit of a chicken and egg question. Do we manufacture that feeling in ourselves by bringing all of the right elements into play? Exactly what is that? That feeling of transcendence, of feeling that you are moving out of the confines of the self into some larger domain.
It makes me think again of your line of getting as near to something as one can without touching.
I think that a good deal of Western religion, to be sure, is aspirational. It's pointing you towards something that you can't quite get.
Which is a good time to talk about the next book on your list.
The Red and Black by Stendhal. Another book that I read in my freshman year in college. I just fell in love with Julian Sorrell. I had to take phys ed classes, and so I signed up for fencing classes. The Red and the Black, of course, is set in the 19th century in France and focuses on this character, Julian Sorrell, who is from a somewhat poor or lower middle class background and is this inexplicably charismatic figure who moves through life. At a very early age, he's fascinated by Napoleon. And there's a book, I think, Napoleon at St. Helena, that is something of his Bible. And he has fantasies of power. He has fantasies of success. He has fantasies of ascending in society in ways that his social status would reflect his inner sense of self. A lot of the elements in the Red and Black are things that I'd grown up with. I'd been around priests And priests are very key to Julian Sorel's rise in society. He's very involved in the role of the church. And he's from a down market background. And I was rather aware of that in college. And also, Julian Sorel is a figure, I mean, perhaps he might be characterized in some ways now as a bit of a sociopath. The novel reflects this somewhat Hobbesian or anti-idealistic worldview. Julian is an emotionally unavailable figure in many ways. Like he's very hard for other characters to read. Stendhal presents him in ways that leave his motives and actual feelings about people open to interpretation. And when he's executed at the end of the novel, his severed head becomes an object of cultish worship. So I was all in for Julian Sorel.
You said that you read The Red and the Black while you were at Penn State. I'm curious what the freshman Albert Mobilio was like and what his expectations were as he left home for the first time.
I was very aware that doors were opening everywhere. I was reading Stendhal in a course where the other books were Crime and Punishment, Swan's Way, War and Peace, some five novels that were particularly, they were European novels, which I had not really been that aware of. And they really just boxed my head open. I was kind of in a bit of heaven. I just was kind of acquiring more and more advanced sense of self with every course that I was taking. Now, this is not to say I was a good student, but my sense of self was moving along rather nicely.
What did you imagine yourself doing? Because you've said, if I'm not mistaken, that you began writing poetry in college, and also that you were inspired by Mark Bolan, the lead singer of the band T-Rex. So two questions here. One was, what is it that you saw yourself doing? And the second is, what was it about Mark Bolan that affected you?
Well, I think he was a part of it. I mean, there was this kind of surrealistic element to some of his lyrics. I mean, what is it? I bought a car, it was old and kind. I gave it my mind, but it disappeared. I mean, I love things like that. And there's a lovely line in another song, book after book, I get hooked every time a writer talks to me like a friend, which I have still decades later quoted to students in writing classes. Not that they have even the beginning notion of who Mark Bolan or T-Rex are. But I think that there was definitely an awareness. I mean, I remember even in high school, a book called Grandfather Rock, which was a compendium of Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel lyrics and the lyrics of a lot of self-important songs at that time and treating them as poetry. Whereas I was a little more attracted to what seemed like more nonsensical lyrics.
And so that was reflected in the poems that you began writing?
I think not that long ago, I came across, I had submitted a poem to the college yearbook, and it was in fact published. It had been digitalized, and I found it online, and it was just so pathetic, but so pathetic that I really enjoyed it. It had something to do with like staring down at the sidewalk that had borne the burden of a million eyes or some crap like that. I think there was a gap between inchoate aesthetic sense and what I knew to be the modes and themes of expression for writing. I think it took a long time for that gap to close.
Well, this is another good moment to talk about the sixth book on your list.
Archaeologist of Mourning, Book of Poems by Charles Olson. It is a good moment because the idea of closing that gap, this book was so important in that regard, because just opening that book up showed me something that I'd seen in Controversy of Poets, but that book being small and dense, Archaeologists of Mourning is a larger format book. And what I saw there was Olson's field composition. I saw the use of line breaks, the use of the display of text on the page in a way that was percussive, in a way that was meaningful, and that had a visual meaning and a literary meaning simultaneously. That was just a revelation. And Olson's voice also, again, I feel like so many of the people on my list have fallen by the way. I mean, Olson is still important perhaps to older writers in ways and in the Pound Olson tradition, as it's sometimes called. But for some of the same reasons that Pound is discounted now, sort of social and political reasons, the same with Olson. I mean, another one of Gertrude Stein's remarks was, Pound is a village explainer, which is fine if you're a village, if not, not. And Olson, like his voice in these poems, he's a pontificator. And I found that intensely attractive at that time.
Which is so interesting, given your sense of not being a pontificator in your own work.
Yes, and I think there was a time when I tried to mimic that. There's a way in which I think in my last book, just to cite something recently, a long poem called Guide for the Discouraged. It's a long poem of aphoristic statements, which I think are parodies of that kind of authoritative village explainer view of things. But I certainly was very attracted to it. That volume contains some of his most famous poems, The Kingfisher's Merse of Egypt, the poem In Cold Helen Thicket, which I read over and over again. It's a poem about an expression then would have been less ordinary than it is now, but an existential crisis experienced by the narrator that is resolved by the decision to make art, to reconstitute a self from, what are the last lines? I have it here. Even as forever wavers, gutters in the wind of loss, even as he will forever waver, precise as hell is, precise as any words or wagon can be made. So it had this idea of the state of wavering, of indecision, of uncertainty, and it seemed like the poet there was offering some kind of, not so much a way out of that, but something to do with that. And I think I was also just attracted to the seriousness that Olson brought to the experience of being alive. I remember in the same course that I read the Stendhal, reading Crime and Punishment, and just having this very sharp sense that my thoughts were not on par with Raskolnikov's. I was thinking about my girlfriend back at home, or I was thinking all these ridiculous thoughts. Why wasn't I thinking about more serious things like the Superman? I should test myself morally by committing a murder. Instead, I was wondering if I could save up enough spare change to make a call home to my girlfriend at the time. The seriousness of Olson, his village explainer-ness, was an elixir.
You've said that you didn't decide to be a poet, that it's not an identity, and that you've always been somewhat ambivalent about it. Why the ambivalence?
I think there are probably more than a few reasons, not the least of which, if we want to circle back to my father saying, what is this shit? There's always this part of me that is a little bit more aware of the pretensions in the culture biz, which I fully engage in myself and enjoy them. But there's a part of me that hangs back, that owes to that kind of ground eye view of things.
You've also, in addition to writing poems, spent a large portion of your professional career writing criticism, which I think is marked by its intimacy, its generosity, and in particular, your engagement with the work as a reader, as opposed to as a critic. This seems to me to be at odds with the stance of many critics. I wonder if that's how your writing naturally evolved, or whether you consciously set out to do something different.
I think that I turned to writing criticism after having been in graduate school and finding that writing about literature in that environment and with the goals that academic writing often sets up to not really reflect the way I thought about literature. And so, yes, I was very interested in trying to reflect the experience of being a reader.
You also said, Albert, that one of the reasons you left Columbia was because, specifically, you said, my intellectual and literary aptitudes were best suited to other venues, to commercial venues.
To journalistic venues, to be sure, because I really didn't want to write in those vocabularies. I still am rather allergic to theory, to literary theory, to art theory, particularly the theories that have been in vogue for the past 30 or 40 years. I started writing mostly for the Village Voice, and the Voice, this was in maybe 1985, was a place where critics could get a start, where you were encouraged to bring yourself into the review. The classic Village Voice review, pioneered by people like Lester Bangs. The first paragraph of your review of a concert was about fixing your hair in the mirror before you went out. There was a hefty amount of personality in those reviews. And of course, that style eventually metastasized throughout the whole culture. And now almost all criticism takes that tack. But at the time, it was very particular to a place like the Village Voice.
Book number 7 on your list is
Murphy, pretty much Samuel Beckett's first novel. If Julian Sorrell is one model of how I might see myself, this kind of emotionally reclusive yet charismatic figure, an attractive figure, a romantic figure, a seducer, Murphy is a hapless clown. And I think that those two figures, ambition and insecurity, a desire to be a decisive, attractive figure, and the reality of being ambivalent and self-doubting, those two figures embody those paradoxes. Julian ends up dead, and as I said, his severed head ends up in a grotto being worshipped. And Murphy, of course, blows himself up in his garret, and his ashes are swept up in the bar below. And that was also a book I probably read a bit later, certainly after the Stendhal. I've written about the first few sentences of that novel, which I just find to be an entire worldview, a theology that I can sign up for. The sun shone, having no alternative, on the nothing new. Murphy sat out of it as though he were free, in a mew in West Brompton. I just love that, the idea of the sun having no alternative. This is our universe, right? There is no bearded man. There is no underlying purpose. The sun is just there because however many personifications in myth and in the pathetic fallacy in literature of attributing meaning to these kinds of things. No, the sun shone, having no alternative. And what does it shine on? The nothing new. The alliteration there is just wonderful. And then to follow that with, Murphy sat out of it as though he were free. The as though phrase gets me every time, as though he were free. What we all pretend, as though we were free.
That about sums it up, doesn't it?
I know. It's really bleak. And that led me on a kind of full exploration of Beckett's work and a lifelong fealty to his worldview in that work.
You said it's really bleak, and you earlier described yourself as a glass half empty sort of person. But there's a tremendous amount of humor in Beckett as well.
Oh, yes, yes. That's absolutely necessary. I taught a freshman seminar, and it was all Beckett. Boy, did I learn that that humor is a particular taste, and that maybe 17 and 18-year-olds away from home for the first time, coping with New York and the subway and all of those emotional problems, that might not have been the wisest decision. I had tears in the classroom on occasion.
Wow. So they found it just depressing.
Yes, the things that I thought were hilarious, like as though he were free, they were resistant to that idea. Like, what do you mean? That proposition, like whether or not human beings are in fact free or have free agency, one could debate that question one way or the other, but that this character in the novel wants to believe that he's free, and it is a dubious proposition. It doesn't have to be an incorrect proposition, but it's dubious.
In your essay, which you touched upon earlier, it's called For Keeps, the Christian C. Sanderson Museum, you write very movingly about Sanderson's obsession with collecting objects that might be insignificant to others, but were very important to him as markers of his life. And speaking of a Christmas star tied to a tree branch, you said, This desiccated pine branch and yellowed star, joined by some rough twine, pierces deeply as a reminder of how intimately things cohabit with us, how they are almost phantom limbs. I wonder if you have any such objects, things you've consciously kept, or things that you can't just bring yourself to get rid of, to discard without quite knowing why.
Well, that Christmas star that was tied to a branch, the detail that I'll add to that is that he kept it because it was tied by his mother. So that knot was something his mother had done. She had handled the rope or the string, and she had made that knot. And then she had died perhaps later that year. So there's a way in which inhering in that object was the physicality of the act of tying something, was some trace element of the mother's touch, her skin on the branch, on the star, on the string. And there are a number of things that I feel attracted to. Bringing down some of these books for our conversation, some of these books I've let go of or lost along the decades. As I said, these are all books from the mid-70s. And I feel, as I describe in that essay, a certain pang about that loss. Whereas the next book that we'll talk about, this Gravity's Rainbow, is the book that I, in fact, had when I read it in whatever, 1974 or 1975. And as I said, the brick here, A Controversy of Poets. I mean, something inheres in this, just holding this, the smell of it. It's a talismanic object to me. And I am a sentimental person in that regard. I do cling to these things.
And you mentioned the bookcase that your dad built for the World Encyclopedia, which you would love to have.
Yes, would love to have that. Maybe this comes with age. When my son was young, I lived in the East Village for about 20 years. And so I would, on a couple occasions, was in that neighbor with my son. And I am one of those people that I'd be pointing to every storefront saying, this used to be this. And I realized that I was living in a palimpsest, in which behind every storefront or building or on every street corner, there was some personal memory that was really occluding what was there for me. Like it was not relevant, or I disdained it because this used to be this cafe, or this used to be a place that was a junk shop where the owners sat outside on barca loungers and bickered, had family arguments on repossessed furniture. So what was there in reality was really beside the point. So I am a sentimental person, and I do cling to things.
In the same essay, you also wrote, objects spoke insistently to Sanderson of their power to mitigate loss, to salvage something durable in the face of unrelenting decay. That's why his memorabilia collection may amuse, transfix, and even unnerve us. But ultimately, it's a source of formidable sorrow. Why is Sanderson's extraordinary collection a source of formidable sorrow?
I visited the Sanderson Museum twice. It seems that he spent a good bit of his life documenting his life rather than living it. In the essay, I talk about him being his own archaeologist or the curator of his own museum. And that strikes me as being a life lived in anticipation of loss. I think that the essay makes some kind of argument or suggestion that one does need to discard these things, that it's not necessarily a good thing, that I sometimes can't see the store that's there on Second Avenue in the East Village because I'm too busy mourning the place that was there. And I'm aware of that tendency in myself. I think that was one of the things that drew me to writing about Sanderson. I think I used the word in that essay that sense of mitigating loss, that it needs to be manageable, that you can save some things, but don't save too many things.
Yes, you sort of allow your son to keep his headless Batman and his three-wheeled race car.
Yes.
But you say he also needs to let go of some special things. He needs to learn that the pang is manageable. That's the end of the essay.
Yeah, I recently lost a cell phone that had a ridiculous number of unbacked up pictures of vacations and all kinds of things like that. I still feel bad about it. And I'm not someone who takes a lot of pictures. This was several years worth of pictures. And the actual physical photos that I have are in files or boxes. And it's not like we ever take them out and look at them. But if you told me that a box of them was gone, I'd probably have the same feeling. But yes, the pang is manageable. There's a bigger pang awaiting us all.
Albert, you mentioned the eighth book on your list a few minutes ago, Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon.
Yes, Gravity's Rainbow. This was a book that I probably saw when I was in high school on a shelf the year it came out in 73. And was intrigued by the title. I was intrigued by its inscrutability. How does gravity have a rainbow? And then I think bought it shortly after that and didn't read it till maybe, I don't know, maybe I was 20, something like that. I was reminded, I brought down this copy off the shelf, which is in battered shape because who knew? I toted it around everywhere. And it's a fourth printing, but it is a first edition. And I opened it up, and there on the back pages, I see a name and an address. And the name is Dennis Rourke, MIU, Fairfield, Idaho, Department of Physics. And what I recalled was that I was hitchhiking, I'm not sure where, but hitchhiking somewhere, carrying this novel with me. I'm sure I was hitchhiking a few hundred miles somewhere, and I have a large postmodern novel with me. That's the only thing I have. I was picked up by this guy, and he was a physics professor, and he was on his way to MIU, is the Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa. He was pitching transcendental meditation and talking about it in the classic sort of two cultures, culture and art and science. We were having this discussion about how he, as a physicist, could believe in the Maharishi or believe in TM as a transcendent path. He said, you should come and visit me. And I wrote down this information in this book, which is probably lessens the value of my copy of Gravity's Rainbow. But this morning, I Googled him, and he died in 2017. And there were a number of encomiums testifying to his religious faith and what a great professor he was, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, it may have lessened the value of your copy of Gravity's Rainbow, but it's revived your memory of that interaction.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, Slothrop, the anti-protagonist of this novel, is a figure very much like Murphy, and I was very much drawn to Slothrop. He is a figure who is more done to than doing. He's not really a free agent in the world. He's the consequence of other events around him. One of the operative conceits in the novel is it's discovered that places where he's had sex, it seems like his erections are predictors of where V2 rockets are going to land. And he's simply disappeared in the novel. I mean, one of the novel's real achievements is a kind of odd example of a certain negative capability is he just ceases to appear in the novel. There's no dramatic exit. He's moving around the post-war zone, I believe in Germany, and he's dressed up as this comic figure, the Rocket Man. There's a place where he's doing something, and then you just don't really read about him again. That seemed to me to be hugely important. The expression anti-novel comes to mind. This is not that, but sort of anti-plot, I suppose. And that seemed to me to be an important development. Many people talk about Gravity's Rainbow as the encyclopedic novel and the beginning of this kind of information novel. Gore Vidal wrote a very famous essay in which he talked about Gravity's Rainbow in a very negative way as being the consequence of research and development. But I think of it a little bit more in terms of its innovations in its narrative structure and its treatment of plot.
The epigraph for your most recent book of poems, Same Faces, is from a note by the artist Ray Johnson to Dick Higgins, sitting here waiting for something to happen. Is that an apt description of your process also? And if so, how do you wait? And how do you recognize when something's happening?
Those are all very good questions. I think I've never been someone who has a regular work schedule. I think there are times when I am sort of moved to write and write a bunch, and then times when I go without writing for a while. Maybe not that I go without writing criticism, because I'm usually writing that pretty regularly. There's an expression to work the problem. I think that there's a way in which maybe I'm a bit lazy. If the problem is a lack of starting place, I don't work that problem as much as I should. I guess from the vantage of being 65, I shouldn't really worry about that now. I don't know what changing things up is going to do at this point. So I think that waiting for me is, I don't think it's sort of an untypical kind of thing. There are things that I was reading Ciaran, and out of that came the long last poem of Insane Faces, A Guide for the Discouraged. There was a kind of pivot in these aphorisms from a statement to some kind of resolution, and that the sense of that pivot, that could be subverted in some way or made disjunct, made not so obvious, like that was something I guess I'd been waiting for. And that poem came out very quickly, and I'm actually continuing that now. I don't know what that will turn into, but I'm still writing that poem.
I wanted to ask about one section of Guide for the Discouraged. You wrote, "I'm always taking the test, the cake I have, or the cake people recall being the best back before we were overtaken by the remorseless now." We've touched on this a little bit in our conversation today, but I wonder if you think that art can do anything to help us navigate the remorseless now.
Yes, I think that art can teach us that the pang is manageable, right? That the cake that we recall is maybe that storefront or that missing book, the things that were better back when. And I think we're always being pulled back. I mean, there's the famous epigram of Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby about being beaten back ceaselessly. I'm probably botching that quote in some way, but about being pulled into the past. And I think that there's a way in which art can kind of mitigate that, can mitigate this need for or desire for the past. And that can be an amusing antidote to remorseless now.
At the end of each interview, I ask my guests to read a short passage from one of the books they've chosen. Albert, what are you going to read for us today?
Just because I haven't laid hands on this book in so long, and it really is in some ways one of the most foreign things to me. I wasn't going to read out of the encyclopedia. I thought I'd just read a very short passage from Rouge et Noir, The Red and the Black. Okay, and this is a description of Julian Sorel in an early chapter as a, well, it says here, as an 18 or 19-year-old. His cheeks were purple, his eyes cast down. He was a small young man, 18 or 19 years old, not appearing very strong, with irregular but delicate features and an aquiline nose. His large black eyes, which at peaceful moments indicated thought and passion, were at the moment sparkling with wild hatred. His dark chestnut hair, worn very long, covered much of his forehead and, when he was angry, gave him a wicked look. Among the innumerable varieties of the human face, there may well be none more striking. His slender, compact form was more indicative of light quickness than of power and energy. Even when very young, his extremely thoughtful air and his pallor had convinced his father he would not live, or if he did, that he'd be a burden on his family. Everyone in the house despised him. He hated his brothers and his father. When the children played in the public square on Sunday, he was always beaten up. He was barely a year old when his beautiful face began to make friends for him among the little girls. Looked down upon by the entire world as a feeble creature, Julian was adored by the old surgeon.
Great. Lovely. Albert Mobilio, thank you so much for speaking with me. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. This has been a discussion that's gone some places that I wasn't quite anticipating, but that's been fun.
Oh, sorry.
Not at all.
This has been Acts and Facts. I'm Richard Croft. My thanks to Charles Curtis for allowing me to use Captain Hume's Galliard by Tobias Hume as the theme music for this podcast.